content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Cindy Fowler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Garden Smart e-newsletter, Gardening for the Blind, Dave's Garden e-newsletter, and from the Piedmont Extension Gardener, and perhaps from Carrots Love Tomatoes and Roses Love Garlic by Louise Riot. We'll start with Dave's Garden e-newsletter, Gourd History and Growing Gourds by Melody Rose. Gourds have been important in human history long before the written word, and we still love and use them today. The gourd is an ancient tool of mankind. The first person to see the benefit of using a gourd shell to scoop water or to store food probably had no idea the significance that this act would have on mankind. There is evidence that gourds were domesticated and intentionally grown as long as 13,000 years ago and probably in use even longer. Gourd species, the genus Legionaria, most likely originated in Africa or Asia, and very possibly both, since there is evidence of two distinct areas where early gourds were cultivated. People soon learned that there were many more things that gourds could do besides the first crude containers or scoops. Early people soon crafted gourds into eating utensils, fishnet floats, musical instruments, masks, beehives, birdhouses, and animal traps. Gourds seem to have appeared in the New World about 10,000 years ago as well. Since gourds have been known to float for over 300 days in seawater and still contain viable seeds, fishnet floats that worked free from their nets could have very well floated across the Atlantic from Africa. Gourds could have also been carried across the Bering Strait during the pre-Siberian migration. However it happened, gourds soon became preferred containers of many of the early peoples. They were lightweight and easy to grow, producing a respectable crop for their needs. There is evidence that gourds were in use as containers long before the advent of pottery. The gourd through history. The Chinese often placed a two-part shell around young gourds that was carved on the inside. As the gourd grew, it filled in the shell, and the resulting gourd had a raised design that often was quite intricate. These gourds were often used in religious ceremonies, either as rattles or containers that held sacred herbs or foods. The molded gourds were often quite beautiful and were prized by the priests and shamans. The round shape of many gourds was a natural amplifier for early stringed instruments, and of course, with an animal skin stretched across the opening, a wonderful drum. Gourds were even considered a form of currency in Haiti for a while, and the national treasury was filled with them. Gourds also played a part in the Civil War. There was a song that was sung called "Follow the Drinking Gourd," and it was a clever way of directing escaped slaves northward, since the star constellations, the Big Dipper and Little Dipper, resemble the dipper gourds often seen near a well. The star patterns are circumpolar constellations and never set in the North American latitudes. At any time during the night, a person can determine which way is north by finding these stars. The North Star is the last star in the handle of the Little Dipper. The bowl stars of the Big Dipper point to the Little Dipper handle. Both constellations are close to each other and are quite easily recognized. Gourds can be eaten. Young gourds are popular in African, Indian, and Asian cuisine, and there are a number of recipes using these small, immature fruits. After all, gourds are cousins of cucumbers and squash. Some gourds cook up better than others, and the calabash and bottle gourds seem to be favorites. They need to be quite young, and the best way to tell if they will work is to scrape a little of the skin with your fingernail. If the meat underneath is green, it will be okay. Use young gourds in store fries and chutneys. Most have a slightly bitter taste, which pairs well with these types of cuisines. Eating gourds isn't for everyone. However, they won't hurt you if you want to experiment. Gourd festivals are popular today. Gourds are still quite popular and beloved to this day. Asians carve, dye, shape, and create lovely works of art from the humble gourd all over the world, and a quick internet search for gourd festivals brings up pages of local celebrations devoted to keeping the art alive, from exhibitions of fantastic gourd creations to short workshops on growing, preserving, and decorating. There's sure to be an activity to please everyone from preschoolers on up. Growing your own gourds. Gourds are popular because they are easy to grow. They do like lots of sunshine and the heat of summer. Most of them need a long growing season of 100 to 180 days. However, even northern gardeners can enjoy them if the plants are started early indoors. Gourds, like their more edible cousins, are annual plants with a life cycle of just one season. Plant in well-drained, fertile soil after all danger of frost is past. Many people plant their gourds on a small, raised mound to ensure good drainage because while gourds love lots of water, they do not like swampy or boggy conditions. Give gourds plenty of growing room. The vines like to spread. Many people encourage their gourds to climb a trellis. This works well for the long-necked dipper gourds because this keeps the neck straight. If grown on the ground, mulch under the vines so that the fruits do not lay on the bare ground. This will prevent rot. Let the plants grow all summer and into fall as the gourds will not be mature until after frost cuts down the vines. After the killing frost, clip the gourds from the vines, leaving several inches of stem since this also prevents rot and takes them to a well-ventilated area to cure. Many people use barns or sheds and even their attics for gourd curing. Cure until the shell seems hard and dry, and when tapped, the gourd sounds hollow. You may even hear the seeds settle inside. When this happens, it is time to clean them if you wish for a slick, even finish. Submerge in a bucket of water with a little bleach added and scrub with a scratch pad until the gourd is clean. Let it dry and it is ready to decorate. Gourd sources. Growing gourds is such an ancient and rewarding undertaking that many gardeners feel the need to grow a few birdhouses or dippers. However, there are so many other shapes and forms that the possibilities are endless. Many pop-up seed racks found in big box stores have a selection, or we have a number of participating vendors offering several different kinds. So if you have the sunshine and the room, try your hand at a few this season. The results are fun. And now from the Garden Smart e-newsletter, The Language of Flowers by Cerisa Klesinski. It seems to be human nature to attach meanings to inanimate objects, and flowers and plants have had symbolic importance for as long as there have been humans to give it to them, whether it be love, affection, friendship, disdain, or grief. Humans assigned a plant to represent each of these emotions. Given the importance of flowers to Valentine's Day, it is the perfect time to examine the language of flowers. Religion, culture, literature, and folklore have all influenced these meanings. The language of flowers is called floriography. And for more than 200 years, books have been written describing the meanings of thousands of plants. And nowhere has flower language played a more important role than in love and courtship. The height of popularity for flower language in the U.S. was the Victorian era. In Victorian times, the rules of decorum and proper etiquette were non-negotiable, and an unguarded remark or a misinterpreted gesture could cause a scandal and ruin reputations. Flowers and their colors sent messages that were too risky for words. Back then, there was nothing casual about giving or receiving flowers, especially between unmarried people. A bouquet or nosegay from a gentleman or a boutonniere from a lady contained a secret language of enormous importance. The kind and color of each flower and how they were arranged, even the hand they were offered or accepted with, was fraught with meaning. Flowers worn or held at the heart meant the giver was accepted and held in high favor. A bouquet held downward meant rejection. A bouquet that was presented upside down meant the opposite of whatever the flowers traditionally meant. And where a woman wore a flower a man gave her indicated whether she considered him a love interest or simply a friend. Not only did a particular flower send a message, but its color did too. Red roses are probably the most famous flower in the language, representing romantic love, but other rose colors hold meanings. Pink roses mean affection. White, chastity and virtue. Yellow, friendship and devotion. Here, a selection of flowers and plants and the sentiments associated with them. Anemone, forsaken. Bachelor's button. Single blessedness, celibacy. Carnation, love, pride, beauty. Chrysanthemum, cheerfulness. Columbine, anxiousness, foolishness. Daffodil, regard. Daisy, innocence, hope. Forget-me-not, true love memories. Foxglove, insecurity. Gardenia, secret love. Hyacinth, playfulness. Iris, good news, eloquence. Ivy, friendship, continuity. Lily of the valley, purity, trust. Marigold, despair, jealousy. Nasturtium, patriotism. Oak, strength. Pansy, thoughts. Rhododendron, danger. Rosemary, remembrance. Snapdragon, deception. Tulip, a declaration of love. Violet, devotion, faithfulness. Zinnia, thoughts of absent friends. It seems odd to associate something as beautiful as a flower with negative emotions, and why a flower was assigned a particular feeling, nasturtiums for patriotism, isn't often known. Nowadays, FTD and Teleflora have lists of flower meanings on their websites. However, you won't find any expressing danger, insecurity, or anxiety. Many books on the language of flowers are also readily available in bookstores and online. So as you bestow flowers on your loved one, have some fun and put together a bouquet that really sends a message. And now from Gardening for the Blind by Larry Kaplan. Gardening is one of the most popular leisure activities of Americans. Many people think that vision impairment will prevent them from enjoying their gardens. Not so. The French painter Claude Monet was an avid gardener who loved flowers almost as much as he did painting. Although Monet eventually lost most of his vision, he did not stop painting, nor did he ever lose his love for gardening. Vision impairment does not have to spoil your enjoyment of gardening either. In fact, with some planning, care, and a readiness to ask for help when you need it, you can have a garden that has a lot more going for it than just eye appear. You can have a garden that appeals to all of your senses. A word of caution. The suggestions here are helpful hints and should not be used as a license to perform dangerous tasks. Be careful not to attempt a project that may place you in a potentially harmful situation. Ask for assistance if you feel at risk. Above all, do not use any chemical compound without first reading the label directions or having someone read them to you. Tips on planning your garden. Getting around the garden. Getting around in the garden should be your first consideration. Most gardens have a lawn, which is attractive and also cushions accidental falls. However, canes and crutch tips can easily get tangled in the grass. Grass can also hide uneven ground, which can throw you off balance. So it's a good idea to use some sort of paving for navigating in the garden or landscape. Paths and paved areas should be smooth, level, and firm. They should always have good traction. Wood becomes very slippery when wet. Provide direct roots through the garden and make sure paths have clear beginnings and ends. Include wind chimes, fountains, or other objects you can hear so you can orient yourself in the garden more easily. Path edges should have distinct differences in texture, such as concrete to grass or bricks to a mulched bed, so you can detect the edges. Use a strip with a change in texture across the path to indicate an entrance to the patio, a tree with interesting bark, or a clump of particularly fragrant plants. The strip should be about 12 to 18 inches wide and can be made from any contrasting paving materials, such as a brick strip across a crushed stone path. Avoid raised edging, which can create a tripping hazard. Working in the garden. Making the garden easy to work in is the next consideration. Raised beds and containers make it easy to reach the soil and the plants. Raised beds are stable and heavy enough for you to sit on the edge or lean on for support, while containers can be moved and take up less room. These structures also cut down the number of special tools you'll need to tend your garden. Avoid structures with sharp corners and edges. The right tools are also important. You'll need to select tools that are durable, lightweight, and easy for you to use. Some tools, like garden trowels, will have engraved markings to indicate soil depth, making it easier to determine how deep to plant bulbs and other transplants. Most garden jobs are easier and less strenuous when you can use both hands. This may be difficult if you need a cane to move around. To make your tools easy to carry, you may want to wear a garden apron, or tool belt with lots of pockets so that you can keep your hands free. A four-wheeled wagon can carry several larger tools and can be pulled with one hand. And now, from Carrots Love Tomatoes and Roses Love Garlic by Louise Rioz. Have some information on castor bean. Experiments have shown that castor beans planted around a garden will repel moles, and they are also good to repel mosquitoes. This is an agricultural crop in some areas where it is grown for the oil in the seed, yet all parts of the plants are poisonous to livestock and humans, particularly the seed. Two or three seeds eaten by a child can be fatal, and as few as six can cause the death of an adult. The beans also carry an allergen that causes severe reactions in some people when handling castor pomace. This danger can be eliminated if the seed heads are clipped off or destroyed before they mature. To form an effective mole repellent, Plant castor beans every 5 or 6 feet around the perimeter of the garden. Use them also as a companion crop. Plant several pole beans close to their bases and let them climb the tall growing plants. The largest variety of castor bean, Sansevieriensis, grows 8 feet tall and has large leaves and beautiful variegated seeds of various colors. Sanguineus grows 7 feet tall and Bronze King 5 feet. Cockroach. Extracts of chinaberry have been found useful against cockroaches and termites. The little-known cockroach plant from Mexico also is valuable in controlling this pest. And cutworm. A 3-inch cardboard collar around young plants extended 1 inch into the ground and 2 inches above will foil cutworms. Use cardboard cut from toilet paper or paper towel rolls, or cut off the top and bottom from a quart-sized milk carton and cut the remainder into 3 collars. A used match stick, toothpick, small twig, or nail set against the plant stem will keep the cutworm from wrapping itself around the plant and cutting it. Oak leaf mulch will repel cutworms too. Eelworm. Eelworms, or nematodes, are tiny, sightless, eel-shaped organisms that pierce the roots of plants to feed or to lay their eggs inside, causing knots to form. When organic matter is incorporated into the soil, it encourages beneficial fungi and other nematodes that feed on the plant parasite variety of eelworms. These beneficial fungi grow in decomposing vegetable matter and kill the nematodes. It is possible to reduce wireworm and nematode attack, too, by placing a heavy dressing of barnyard manure on grassland before plowing. And now about the daylily. The daylily has long been a mainstay of perennial plantings. The usual method of propagation is by clump division, easily done in autumn, but for best results, a clump should not be divided more often than every 2 or 3 years. Another reproduction is by proliferation. The sturdy little rootless plants that develop along the flowerscapes, the stalks, in the axil between the rudimentary stem leaves and the stalk eventually die if they do not touch the earth. Nature probably intended them to spread the plant when the flower stalk finally breaks and falls to the ground. Give nature an assist. When the flowering period is past and the stalk starts to dry, cut off the proliferation by severing the stalk about 2 inches below. Insert the proliferation in a pot full of good growing mix with the base just below the soil surface. Keep soil moist. Roots will soon develop from the base. After good root development, set the plant out in the garden. If you have a slope or terrace too steep to mow, try planting daylilies and iris together. Their roots will hold the soil, and their blossoms, which arrive successfully, the iris blooming first, will delight you all summer. Daylilies are unaffected by the juglone washed from the black walnut's leaves. The flower buds are delicious, dipped in batter and fried. Not generally known is the fact that daylilies are a tasty food. Buds and blossoms can be sautéed in butter with a little salt and used alone or added to a zucchini and tomato dish. They may also be dipped in batter and fried. They may even be dried for later use in soups and stews. And cats. Although cats sometimes do catch birds, their hunting instincts also leads them to keep the garden clear of snakes, mice, rats, grasshoppers, and tarantulas. Cats that rarely have the opportunity to go outside enjoy greenery to nibble on. Oats fulfill this need, providing a safe, healthy distraction from nibbling on houseplants, some of which may be poisonous. Catnip, a perennial mint, is also a favorite of felines who are stimulated by its leaves. Doggone, man's best friend can be a nuisance sometimes. He can leave yellow patches on the lawn, ruin shrubs, and dig in your best flower bed. Mothballs or naphtha flakes around the beds will discourage him, but should not be used where small children can pick them up, or pound small sticks a foot or so apart in the region you're trying to protect. Circus in town? Check around. You may find exotic animal manure available for the taking. If fresh, it's a valuable repellent for animal pests. Let it age a bit before using around plants, or dig it in freely between rows. Bengal tiger and lion manure may be just what you need to make your garden a roaring success. If you have a pool in your garden, stock it with fish. Goldfish are excellent for consuming mosquito larvae, and so are the small top minnows called mosquito fish. Snakes, the harmless, so-called garden variety of snakes, catches and kills many injurious insects and is itself not poisonous, protected in the Southwest. Be very careful around berry patches, which are attractive to rattlesnakes. Tarantulas, the big hairy spiders, are also attracted to berries. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Cindy Fowler, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. You can call us at 919-832-5138.
Purpose of the North Carolina Reading Service is to connect people who are blind and print impaired with each other, their families, and the community by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. You can also visit our website at ncreadingservice.org. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.